You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Hey, folks, we're here to tell you about our February class called Blood and Belief, Exploring the Biblical Texts of Terror.
Something we've talked about here on the podcast and in past classes is about violence in the Bible, and we still get questions about it all the time.
The Bible contains really vivid depictions of violence, ranging from personal acts of harm to sweeping divine retribution on a cosmic scale.
What can we learn from these biblical texts of terror that illustrate so many kinds of violence, and how can we use them to reflect on the violent acts, words, and ideas that we encounter in our world today?
If you're curious about those questions, you can join class teachers Caroline Blythe and Emily Colgan, who are biblical scholars and partners in crime, as co-hosts of the Bloody Bible podcast, as they cover topics like violence and power, violence and gender, and the legacy of biblical violence.
The class is happening live on February 17th from 8 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, followed by an extended Q&A session for members of the Society of Normal People. When you sign up, you'll get access to the live class, downloadable class slides, and you'll get the recording afterwards in case you can't make it.
It's pay what you can until the class ends, then it'll cost $25 to purchase the recording.
Head to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/terror to sign up. And of course, if you want this class and all of our other classes, plus a great community, early access to podcast episodes and more, you can become a member of our online community, the Society of Normal People, for as little as $12 a month at thebiblefornormalpeople.com/join.
Well. Here we are again.
Here we are again.
Welcome to season 9.
You tired of us yet, folks?
Season 9.
Too bad. Season 9. I haven't done very much in my life for 9 years solid.
I know.
Except my t-shirts and my underwear. I have those for more than 9 years, but that's about it.
That's really...
And baseball.
That's really gross.
Oh, and family. Well, there are a lot of things, but not as many as you would think that I've done for 9 years in a row. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I don't know when we started this. Were we really thinking this will go on forever? I don't know. We were just, let's do this, and we didn't have a time frame in mind. But 9 years, that's almost a decade.
I know. That's a long time. I didn't know if you'd still be alive.
I barely am, frankly. Doctor's appointments today. Anyway.
So today we're going to talk about, well, it's just us today.
It's me and you, yeah.
And we're going to talk about, I don't know. I forget what we said.
What we're going to talk about.
What did we
I'll
say?
I'll take it from here, Jared. Talk about getting old. About the Bible and the modern mindset. And
Biblical criticism.
Yeah, well, biblical
and the modern mindset.
Fine. Biblical criticism and the modern mindset, which is the gift that keeps on giving. And this is the kind of thing we could talk about at various angles, literally for hours upon hours upon hours. There's so much going on here. So we're going to touch on some of that stuff here.
Yep. All right, let's get into the episode.
I think the Bible is about as impossible to wrap up into a modernist mindset as anything, because it's ancient, it's weird, it's diverse, it's all over the place, it's internally contradictory. You just can't make the system out of it, but it can be a means of grace, too, for the life of faith.
So klingt Weihnachten bei Rewe. Jetzt festlich sparen bei deinem Weihnachtseinkauf. Diese Woche bei Rewe Ferrero Rocher je 200 Gramm Packung nur 2,99 €. Außerdem Mionetto Prosecco Spumante Doc je 0,75 Liter Flasche nur 5,99 €. Festlich sparen bei Rewe. Dein Markt.
Achtung, es folgt eine wichtige Botschaft Ihres Mobilfunkanbieters.
Ey Mann, es gibt Leute, die drücken immer noch zu viel Knete ab.
Nein, nicht frisch.
Mit Barra ist der irgendwie smarter.
Ja, smart.
50 Gigabyte für nur 8,99 €.
Wenig Knete.
Ich zahle doch nicht mehr für weniger.
Nee, das wäre auch schön blöd.
Le
Barra, deine Knete, deine Entscheidung.
Nice.
Alle Details zu unseren Tarifen finden Sie unter lebarra.de.
We're going to talk today about biblical scholarship and the modern mindset. So we're going to be talking about two things and how they came together in biblical criticism. And it's a little bit of a genealogy. You know, where did it come from? Why did it come? What were they doing? And how did that evolve over time? So let's start where genealogies usually begin, in the beginning.
Genesis. Well, yeah, and I think, you know, it is a meshing of, you know, the Bible and the modern mindset, and there are data points in terms of, like, here's what biblical people were saying fairly early on in the modern period in terms of the Bible, but also just more philosophically, what's behind that. So,
and maybe I'll just say this as a way to set up where this is all going, and that is, in the modern period, the times we're going to be talking about, we start getting this mixture, this admixture of a couple of things that really come to a head in the 20th century.
Yes.
In America, at least, that become problematic for Christian expression. So, or at least in certain traditions. But I think that's what we're going to talk about.
Yeah. And I think in terms of, you know, in the modern period, this all began with Genesis and the Pentateuch. That was really the focus. People weren't talking as much early on about, you know, Isaiah. That came later on, but it was really the Torah. And people had noticed for a very, very long time, there are some problems in the Pentateuch for saying Moses wrote it. And that's really the issue. That's what began all this. And around 1100, there is a rabbi, Abraham Ibn Ezra, who noticed, you know, Orthodox rabbi, but he noticed there were things in Torah that just don't make sense for traditional views of authorship. And one of his examples is Genesis 12:6, where God is taking Abraham on a tour of the Holy Land, the Promised Land, rather. And, you know, there's almost a parenthetical aside in verse 6 says, now at that time, the Canaanites were in the land. Mm-hmm. And Abraham Ibn Ezra, Ibn means son of, but Abraham Ibn Ezra said, this has a meaning, and the one who understands it will keep quiet. Because it seems to imply that whoever's writing this is living at a time when the Canaanites weren't in the land any longer. So we're talking, you know, after the conquest period. So he's saying that, yeah, this is a clue that this is written significantly after the time of Moses. Now, the thing is that, that's great. And people had noticed these things. He wasn't the first. He wasn't the only one. Mm-hmm. But Jews could read. You know, these rabbis could read, and they weren't particularly bothered by it, but they noticed it, but they didn't make much out of it. The modern period, and, you know, whenever we want to start that, I'm thinking of the 17th century, and I'm thinking of Benedict or Baruch Spinoza, the philosopher. What happened then was a more systematic, rigorous academic account for why Torah looks the way that it does. And Spinoza wrote, which I've only poked in, it's a philosophical tractate, but the theological political tractate, where he is briefly, I think, undermining the church and state mess that has pretty much ordered people's lives. And the way to undercut the state is to undercut the religion, and the way to undercut the religion is to say, you know, the Bible, it's not all that. It's got some problems in it, and you need to read it with the normal light of reason and to sort of get into it. And he says, you know, one of the chapters in his theological political tractate is entitled, "It is clearer than the sun." This is the title of the chapter. "It is clearer than the sun at noonday that Moses did not write the books ascribed to him." And he goes on to show that,
right?
You know, pretty convincingly.
Well, it's interesting, a couple of things that you said. One, that the Mosaic authorship is such a big deal. When, if we're talking about the Bible, that's really more of a tradition around the Bible than the Bible itself, right?
Right.
I mean, the Bible doesn't say Moses wrote the Pentateuch.
It doesn't say that anywhere. I mean, it became part of a Jewish tradition, which then gets into Jesus in John's Gospel, chapter 5, mentions something very similar. Yeah. So it's part of the tradition.
So we got to a place where to undercut a tradition is to undercut the biblical witness.
Right.
Which is, I think, is important here when we're talking about what we're talking about, because we're talking about what's the role of tradition and interpretation in, you know, how is that authoritative throughout these periods? But we have Ibn Ezra in the 1100s, right? So we're firmly in the medieval period, kind of, if we're looking at a timeline here. These things are noticed. I mean, we could go back further and talk about all the things that the rabbis noticed in these texts that didn't seem to be bothered by it, right? All the discrepancies.
It's more of a challenge, just sort of, well, how can we work through
how
this?
How do we figure this out? Right. And how, but it didn't seem to need to be defended against in any significant way. Then we get to, you know, the 17th century, 16th, 17th centuries. And now all of a sudden, this is problematic. So what happened? This is where that mindset shift comes in. What happens in those 500 years? Why all of a sudden now it's so problematic?
Right.
What do you have any thoughts
on
that?
Well, I mean, I only have, from my perspective, and I don't want to blame the Protestant Reformation on everything, but the Bible came to be elevated in the sense, like, this is the book, and mm-hmm. it has one meaning, and we can't diverge from that, and it becomes this sole rule of faith. That's a bit of a caricature, because history is much more complicated than that. I don't want to give people the impression that Protestants were stupid or something, or Calvin or Luther, mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. But we did move away from the sense that, for example, there are multiple senses to Scripture. There are various levels, and they're legitimate. And the literal meaning is the most boring one, quite frankly. And mm-hmm. An allegorical meaning is much more important. Calvin felt that allegory was a satanic device to get people away from the literal meaning. So he had very, very little...
Calvin, he's always just so diplomatic.
Well, the thing is, I mean, I get it in a sense, you know, given his mm-hmm. time period, his era, and, you know, the rise of scientific thinking. And there's, you know, there is one explanation for why the planets move the way they move. And there's one thing about the Bible, and there's one meaning to it. You can have multiple meanings. That's part of that modern mindset, I think. And so, you know, that gets embedded, I think, it's baked into the Christian experience in Europe that caught on. And you have Spinoza coming along a little bit after that saying, yeah, well, let's take this to the next level.
Yeah, I think what I'd maybe say to that is, maybe to answer my own question, just after hearing you say that, is I wonder, sometimes I think we don't want to, I would say my opinion, I don't know if we want to blame the Reformation. I think the Reformation was an effect of something that had been happening for a couple of hundred years.
Exactly right.
And so for me...
We'll talk about that, yeah.
Yeah, because I think for me, Calvin is trying to figure out a new foundation for authority within Christianity. It's not like he's coming in and wrecking things. He's actually coming into a political and social situation that has been wrecked and saying, what do we do now? And so, you know, when we talk about the modern mindset, and I talk about this a little bit in my class on the making of the modern mindset, if we think of these influences, you know, it's funny, you talk about the 12th century with Ibn Ezra, right around that same time, we have the rise of republics for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, historically in the medieval period, God is sort of that foundation, and that'll actually continue. We can talk about that. But I think in the modern period, God is still the foundation. God just now gives us reason.
Yeah,
that becomes the tool that we can trust. But how can we trust reason? Like Descartes basically comes back to like, well, we can only trust it because God sort of gives us, you know, he wouldn't do that to us. So we can trust our reason. But God's still at the foundation of that in the modern period, for most of the modern period. And so there's still God. But then in the medieval period, it's the church and state. It's the hierarchy of the tradition baked into these two institutions. And so whenever you have in the 12th century, Florence, and the rise of these republics, we start losing that hierarchy on the state side. And then you have Petrarch and the return to like classic literature and the return to biblical sources. They start finding manuscripts of Greek and Hebrew.
Yeah, back to
and they
the
start
sources.
Scratching their head and saying, yeah, ad fontes, back to the sources. They start scratching their head and saying like, huh, maybe we should. And that's what leads to then Erasmus and then Luther. I think, you know, maybe is... gives him too much credit. I don't think he even wanted the credit of this thing that's been happening for a couple hundred years. So we have these two, the twin towers of church and state that are radically shifting during this time. We have Florence and the republics, which eventuate in these, you know, monarchs getting their heads chopped off in the 18th century. And now we have a whole new way of doing things, but that was how we got information from God to the people in a way that we could trust it, the church and the state.
Yeah,
and we have these revolutions on both sides, and Calvin's like, okay, well, maybe this, like,
right?
Maybe this.
So you're saying that it's this historical consciousness of going back to the beginning, the way things were. Let's look at the earliest man. Let's not It's not just, you know, right, the Bibles that we have that we've inherited. Let's go back and look at these early manuscripts, right?
And we'd been trusting these traditions for centuries, and now we have many. So there's a conflict in itself of like, oh, but what happens when the sources contradict the tradition, like Mosaic authorship, which is not biblical, it's a tradition, and then we get Spinoza and so on. That's like really starting to ramp this up.
Which people didn't really, I mean, I think it's fair to say people in the medieval period weren't running around trying to defend Mosaic authorship because it just wasn't an issue.
Exactly.
Right. But it became an issue, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're starting to dig into the manuscripts themselves and things become a little more complicated.
Well, and again, I would say because also we didn't need to question it because we got an inherited tradition through these hierarchical institutions. And so there was no consciousness around why would we question that? Yeah. But when that starts to fall apart and we need to start building up a new authority and reason becomes it, then we can't help but start asking those questions because we develop processes by which we question things.
And so Calvin and others were saying, mm-hmm, what's our foundation
here? I think Calvin was questioning the traditions and saying, well, let's just go to the Bible. And then biblical criticism starts turning it on.
That's
that
exactly right.
And saying, well, let's not just go to the traditions. The Catholic Church maybe isn't the only thing that has all these challenges or problems with it. Maybe the text itself does. So I think Calvin was willing to go with the tradition criticism and then sort of let's put our trust in the text. And I think as we move along in the modern period, criticism develops these processes and methodologies. Right. That starts saying, well, we're not just going to go there. We're going to actually look at the text, and we see problems there too.
Right. And you know, people have sort of blamed Luther for these things as well. I mean, it's easy to blame people exactly for things, but that it's don't trust the church.
Right.
And then people like Spinoza came along and said, why trust anything that people tell you?
Right.
Look into it. It's the natural light of reason that God has given you,
right,
that you can be skeptical about, and you probably should be skeptical. Mm-hmm. And that's a shift, I think, from the medieval period. And it was hundreds of years in the making. Right. It didn't just happen overnight.
Yeah, and I think before we move on to kind of that next phase post-Spinoza, I think that's a big takeaway. And I think it's something we do at the Bible for Normal People, is like recognizing that there's a context to all of this. So we can say Luther, we can say Petrarch or Erasmus or Calvin,
right,
but they were all swimming in a water. If it wasn't Luther, it'd have been someone else. If it wasn't Calvin, it's the time where human consciousness is moving. Is it progress? I don't know, but it's definitely shifting in this time period. And so then what we do with the Bible is also getting swept up in this time period.
Ah, da ist meine Prime-Bestellung.
Was? Jetzt schon?
Nur eine Sache begeistert so wie die schnelle Lieferung mit Prime. Und zwar das tolle Unterhaltungsangebot von Prime.
Was schauen wir uns an?
Fallout ist zurück mit Staffel 2. Unsere Lieblingshelden kämpfen sich durch die brutale und bizarre Einöde, um dahin zu gelangen, wo alles begann. New Vegas.
Schnelle, kostenlose Lieferung, geniale Unterhaltung und mehr gibt's bei Prime. Für nur 8,99 € pro Monat. Werde jetzt Prime-Mitglied. Die Inhalte können Werbung enthalten. Fortlaufende Mitgliedschaft. Mehr auf amazon.de/prime.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
So where do we go from there?
Well, that's where people started. I mean, scholars started systematically looking at, like, why do we believe anything that we believe? Mm-hmm. And who wrote this stuff anyway? Who wrote Torah? Who wrote the Pentateuch? Just sort of obvious things were talked about. Like, you know, it's sort of written in the third person. It's about Adam. It's about Noah. It's about Abraham. It's mm-hmm. about Moses. So he's a third person figure, and you have that passage in Numbers, chapter 11 or so, about, now Moses was more humble than any man on the face
of
the earth.
I always love that one.
And that's sort of a jab to the idea that Moses wrote it. Well, okay, but Moses wrote most of it, but some editor put that in. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, but there's no really difference in terms of the style linguistics between that verse and everything else around it. So it begins to call into question whether Moses could have written about himself in the third person, calling himself humble,
mm-hmm.
right? And those are the things that sort of just came to light and looked at more systematically. And then you have things like, you know, the diversity in the Bible, mm-hmm. you know, and how you have laws that contradict each other within Torah that are all given by God, but yet they're different. And the big one I was talking about with my students is the slave laws concerning the keeping of Hebrew slaves. In Exodus, in chapter 20, you can keep Hebrew slaves, but a male slave can go free after 7 years should he wish to. If he came in married, he can leave with his wife. But if he came in single and married somebody, only he can go free, the woman can. But it's very clear women don't have that right.
Mm-hmm.
In Deuteronomy, they do. And it's not like reading between the lines. It's twice in that chapter 15 in Deuteronomy, it's men and women can go free after they can declare their freedom after 7 years. And that's a shift. That's a change. And how can you have the law given by God to Moses and Mount Sinai, the same God, the same Moses, saying two different things in Exodus and Deuteronomy, and then just to throw Leviticus in there, chapter 24, 25, around there, it's like, what are you talking about having Hebrew slaves? Don't you know you were slaves in Egypt yourselves? You can't enslave your mm-hmm. own people. You can enslave others. I mean, some apologists use this as an example of like, you know, you're not supposed to have slaves. Not Hebrew mm-hmm. indentured servants right. is really what they were. But you can certainly enslave anybody else. Mm-hmm. But it's just the rules about what it means to be a Hebrew and to be a slave of your own people. That clearly shifted. And so you've got different voices there talking to us. And you know, Ben Sommer, we had him on mm-hmm. the first season, I think he was. He wrote a beautiful book on this problem, and you should go back and listen to that episode. But you know, he addresses that as like it's the voice of God that has to be interpreted in different settings and different times. But that's just it. It's the voice of God being interpreted by different communities at different times and different places and coming up with different answers to this. And that sort of doesn't help the idea that Moses wrote all this essentially in one sitting.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what people would take systematic views of the Bible just in Deuteronomy. And I mean, we're not going to go through all the right. reasons why people say that, but just one of my favorite ones is the book of Deuteronomy, which is the longest first-person narrative where Moses is doing the speaking. And it's also the least Mosaic, if you really look at it carefully. You have the editor at the beginning saying, these are the words Moses spoke on the other side of the Jordan. Well, Moses died on the eastern side of the Jordan. He never came over. So whoever's saying this is saying, yeah, we're reminiscing here about Moses and what he said. And so Moses does a lot of talking, and you get to chapter 4, verse 37, where, I mean, I really encourage people to read chapter 4, verses 37 and 38. Moses is giving sort of a review of where we've been, mm-hmm. right? Actually, can I read this? I have it right here, yeah. The Ten Commandments are going to be in chapter 5, but he's giving this review of their history. And he says that he, God, brought you out of Egypt with his own presence. That's a reference to something in the past. And he keeps going, by his great power, driving out before you nations greater and mightier than yourselves to bring you in, giving you their land for a possession, as it is still today. So this is a reference to not only the Exodus from Egypt in the past, but giving you the land, driving out these nations. This is the conquest of Canaan,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
As it is still to this day. Well, what day is that, right?
It's like double down. It is in the past,
yeah.
and then it says, as it is still today.
So what is that day? And the thing is that, you know, it's not that the writer of Deuteronomy is an idiot. I think the writer knows what he's doing, mm-hmm. and he's not trying to pass this off as something that Moses necessarily said, but this is a piece of theology. But the point, rather, is that I don't think Moses wrote that. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't mm-hmm. write about his own death at the end of the book, and it's not like an "I gotcha" moment for anti-Christians to point that out. It's very, very clear. You know,
well, and again, even the way we're framing this conversation right now, that you're framing it, I'm still, it's telling that it matters. why does it matter whether Moses wrote the Pentateuch or not? Even to ask the question is because we need this text to be authoritative, and we have made the argument that if Moses wrote it, it's more authoritative than if Moses didn't write it.
Right. Because you have an eyewitness now to all the events. That's really the thing.
And that goes back to
the modern way of
the way we needed this to be. I don't know how to say it a different way, but I think we have to question even how we frame this, because I think for a lot of us, it's so inherited, we don't even think to question it.
Right.
Like
exactly right. Yeah.
We've inherited the idea that Moses writing it is important because we think that an eyewitness gives us closer factual truth than a non-eyewitness, and that we need the Bible to be accurate historically because of the place that it holds in our epistemological framework, which is a fancy way of saying how we know things.
Mm-hmm. And how can we be sure we're right about
it? It is the tool we have used to unlock certainty about how the world really is. And that all of that is an inherited tradition. That is not a given.
Part of the modern mindset,
right. Which is a tradition that mm-hmm. we've inherited from our modern forefathers and mothers, is this way of thinking.
Even preceding the modern period, as you're saying.
Right. It started in the late medieval period, because this is, nothing is black and white.
And once you left, open the Pandora's box, it's like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say, once you start looking at the Bible with a historical consciousness, mm-hmm. you've left the medieval period,
mm-hmm.
largely left the medieval.
Right.
You've left the ancient period. You've left the New Testament period.
Right.
You've left the Old Testament period, in my opinion, right?
It's
now different, and you're going to see how the sausage is made, at least theories about how the sausage is made. And one of the true pillars of the modern period concerning the Torah is like, there is no way this was written in the second millennium BC by one person. There are too many voices here, and there are too many passages and mm-hmm. sections that are screaming to you saying, this is probably exilic or even post-exilic,
right?
And that's what the historical dimension of the study of scripture has done, which is a child of the rise of modernity.
Well, and maybe can you let's dig in a little bit more specifically. When mm-hmm. you say history or historical consciousness, when we look at the Pentateuch and say, this couldn't have been written here, and we couldn't have, what are the tools you're using? What are the tools that biblical scholars and biblical criticism has used to get to that? Because when we talk about history and how we figure out what's historical,
right,
we're talking about tools and a set of processes, and that's kind of what we mean by that, right? So what is happening? Because I could just see people saying, well, I guess I would just say there's like an inerrantist version of history, so we have to be more specific,
right? Well, I think the tools come around in order to help us understand what we're reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, an inerrantist reading is not a reading that flows from the text itself. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, Moses writing about his own humility or about his own death in the past tense, and for Moses to say, no one knows to this day where his body is, this is how Deuteronomy ends. He dies, he's buried, and we don't know where his grave is, and no prophet has come along like Moses.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to try to make arguments, which some people have done historically, to say that, well, Moses could have written that by inspiration. And okay, that's fine, but we're not in a historical conversation at that
point. And I think that's important. Mm-hmm. If someone says that, then they have extracted themselves out of the process.
Out of the contemporary process, the way we think about things over the last few years.
I think one thing I'm picking up on, right, is what you're saying is we have collectively decided what's reasonable. And what would we've decided that based on a certain set of processes, which is undergirded by the scientific method, right, of hypotheses and tests and thousands of iterations of that. within a particular field of experts. Mm-hmm. And then I'm trying to think of how to articulate this. So I think sometimes what an errantist can do is use reason when it suits them, use that process. And then when it doesn't suit them, they have a trump card that sort of extracts them out of that process. And then they want to kind of give and take. And then I think what can be frustrating for me is the same process that's undergirding biblical criticism also undergirds medicine and technology. And we're fine with those processes. The challenge becomes when reason comes in conflict, right? That the scientific process and how we become experts in things, when it comes into conflict with the thing that we think actually gives us certainty, which is an inerrant Bible.
Mm-hmm. Which is a tradition.
We have to sort of take the inerrantist Bible position for that, and then we're going to just put ourselves right back in to this thing. And I think that, for me, is one of the most challenging parts of an inerrantist position, is you want to be reasonable. You want to say reason is at the ground of things. And then you say, well, the Bible is reasonable in this same way. And then when it comes into conflict, we have to sort of figure
out
these.
That's apologetics.
That is the invention of apologetics. That's right. Why it exists as a machine.
And I think that this is analogous to scientific investigations and the belief in God, for example, mm-hmm. like evolution. Well, I mean, you can't have evolution because then God's not real. And people can come along, like myself, and say, well, that has nothing to do with whether God is real or not. It just mm-hmm. has to do with whether the Bible is an explanation of human origins. That's a very
right.
different kind
yes.
of thing.
Yeah.
So I would say the same thing about, exposing is the wrong word. Just observing, I think, that it's mm-hmm. really hard to come to the conclusion that Moses wrote the Pentateuch. That doesn't, to me, undermine the existence of God, the nature of God. Those, to me, are very different kinds of right. discussions. This is just a historical snapshot of how people process this in the past. And we're coming to understand that process a little bit by certain tools that, I don't know if source criticism is a tool as much as it is an observation of different voices that then comes up with theories to say, here's how I explain the different voices.
Right.
They come in a chronological order historically, or maybe they don't, or maybe there's one big writer and people added to it. But the point is that the Torah has a historical development. That is, as in biblical scholarship, that is as strong a statement as there's a fossil record in evolutionary theory.
Right.
People say that's not true, but it is. So, those are observations that people have made, not because they have anti-Christian biases or anti-supernatural biases, but because the biblical data themselves push us in a certain direction, as they did Abraham Ibn Ezra, who was not a modern person, mm-hmm. but on the cusp of that, perhaps, Renaissance and
right.
humanism and all those kinds of things, right? So, they were thinking along those terms, but they weren't modern in our sense. And I think we have to be open to the fact that we have perspectives as well. And I definitely acknowledge that. But from where I sit, I don't know what else to say. It's like saying the sun is up.
Dein altes Sofa zerfällt langsam. Und die Black Friday-Angebote sind wirklich unschlagbar. Aber dein Gehalt kommt erst Anfang des Monats. Kein Problem. Mit der PayPal-Bezahlung nach 30 Tagen. So hast du jetzt mehr Spielraum beim Bezahlen und der Betrag wird nach 30 Tagen automatisch und kostenlos von deinem Konto oder deiner Karte abgebucht. Alle Infos auf paypal.de/30 Tage. PayPal es. Vorbehaltlich Kreditwürdigkeitsprüfung verfügbar mit deutschem PayPal-Konto für Einkäufe zwischen 1 und 2.000 Euro.
Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma, trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
I don't want to get too abstract or philosophical, but when you say...
Oh, yes.
that recognizing the historical development of the Pentateuch, uh-huh. therefore Moses didn't write the Pentateuch, mm-hmm. doesn't mean God doesn't exist. The only thing I would challenge with that is I think it does mean a certain version of God doesn't
Absolutely.
Exist.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to name mm-hmm. because that's really the argument.
You may need to rethink your understanding of the tie between the reality of God and this book.
Because if God, if what we mean by God is the one who provided us a text that is inerrant and perfect, a perfect prism through which if we just trusted it, it would give us all the facts about the world that we need, both from a historical and a scientific aspect, but also a moral and spiritual aspect, then that God doesn't exist if right. we accept the historical
development.
So therefore,
God can't be real.
Right.
And that is...
But that's within that. That's within, I would say, a modernist
yes,
understanding exactly right. of Christianity, yeah. which for me, the irony is, I think evangelicalism is the pinnacle of modernist Christianity, yeah. even though it is the chief enemy in its own mind of right. modernist Christianity.
It's a many have said this, it's a thoroughly modernist experiment yeah. in terms of the articulation of Christianity, which, you know, departed from earlier ways of mm-hmm. I mean, most of the church has not thought this way.
Right.
And some people are saying, and it's starting not to think that way anymore. I mean, people are moving, call it postmodernism, whatever. But that's why postmodernism is an attempt, I think, one way of putting it, to reclaim mm-hmm. A view of reality that's not limited by modernism, which has done many beautiful and wonderful and fantastic things. But
yeah.
it is a myth in a sense too, that it's not giving us it's a structure. It's a right. structure by which we explain things.
Yeah. Well, and we can't conflate reason and the scientific method is not modernism.
Right.
That continues mm-hmm. to be the gift that keeps on giving. That's very helpful. When I think of postmodernism, more and more, I have to own what I mean by that is more in the 20th century when this came to a head in America, right? We have biblical criticism that has been working its way through seminaries and churches for a couple of hundred years, and we kind of come to a crisis of faith in the early 20th century in this fundamentalist modernist debate.
Scopes Monkey trials,
yeah, yeah. All of these kind of things where it's sort of liberal conservative split within Christianity. For me, one way, I'm sure it's very complex and there's a lot of ways to look at it, but one way to look at that is that's when this crisis of what is the relationship of the Bible and Christian expression to modernist categories and the modern project. And I feel like evangelicalism actually doubled down on the modern experiment
yes, right.
to find the certainty of our knowledge and the modern sort of the breakaway of more progressive, quote, liberal churches was to actually follow the path of what science did, which is to say, we're just going to give up on that project. It doesn't mean we can't know things. It just means maybe it was a fool's errand to try that undoubtable, unshakable, yeah. foundational truth that we can then build a pyramid of knowledge on top of. Maybe we should abandon that. It seems like we found the process by which we can come to knowledge that helps with the medicine and technology and moralism and all of that. Let's just go with that. And so for me, when I say postmodern, I just mean we kind of gave up on that project. And I think that could explain part of where this came to.
Well, postmodernism is the acknowledgement of the limitations of the modernist
yes.
agenda,
yep.
right? And I think, I think that's really important. It's not, I mean, you know, the liberal church, for example, mm-hmm. 19th century, 20th century, they dried up. People aren't going anymore. And, you know, that's probably true, mm-hmm. you know? But there's also a post-liberalism, which is saying, okay.
right.
Now, constructively, what does the Bible mean to our community? To me, that's the question to be
yes,
asked.
Right.
How can we, you know, I've used in how the Bible actually works, I use the word reimagine a lot. Mm-hmm. I like that word. Mm-hmm. How do we reimagine God? How do we imagine scripture, the nature of scripture, what it does, how it works for us? And even what it is, what is the Bible?
Right.
And what do we do with it? Right. I mean,
yeah.
I think we talk about that a lot.
Yep.
Those we're driven to those questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I've become more aware of how infrequently people are willing to ask that question of themselves.
Right.
How uneasy they might be. And I understand why, because they're in that mindset, right? Mm-hmm. They're in that mindset. Like, it's one or the other. I mean, a common comment I get and on social media is, almost doesn't matter what I say. If you lose any part of the Bible, you lose all of it, because it's God's word. Right? Mm-hmm. And my response is, yeah, but read it, you know, and look at its behavior, look at how it acts. And if we have a theory of the Bible that doesn't take into account things like, there's no way Moses could have said this, you know, we're participating in the perpetuation of, I think, kind of myth, right? In the negative sense of the word, mm-hmm. I think, just something mm-hmm. that's not true, but that gives us meaning. And ironically, that to me, that shows a certain lack of faith in God. That, you know, it has to be a certain way, or it can't, and none of it can be true.
Well, and I think the frustrating thing for me is when we don't recognize the way that you're insisting it has to be hasn't been how it always was. You're doubling down on a particular way of thinking in the West over 500 years.
The church has always believed this.
Yeah. And you're doubling down on that and saying that is now the essence mm-hmm. of Christianity.
Right.
Which for me is just short-sighted and untrue. Right. And it's just, I think I'm sad about it, because it's like, well, you're going to, what it comes down to is, it actually is going to, I think, lead to a lot of people abandoning the faith. Because the more and more people move past the modern mindset into a more process-oriented quantum understanding of the universe and God and how all this has to work together, we're evolving. The tradition's evolving just as it always had. And there's always people who are refusing to get off the Titanic as it sinks.
That's right, yeah.
Because they're on the real Titanic. And right. I'm going to go down with it, even though there's like another boat that's perfectly fine mm-hmm. that will just carry the tradition on.
Right.
And it's like, I just want to be like, and I get frustrated with apologists who are trying to keep people in the fold of modernist, inerrantist exactly Christianity,
right.
saying you have to choose. It is either or. And so they just are choosing to be atheist, or choosing to be like, I'm going to be a spiritual nun, because I've been forced to choose. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's sort of like, well, you're the one forcing people to choose. Christianity isn't.
Right. So, yeah. Well, I mean, it's been baked into the culture of the past. I mean, I think especially probably since the 19th century, maybe even before, but especially since then, it's baked in. I mean, I've heard the rhetoric, you've heard it too. Metaphorically speaking, our forefathers spilled blood over this issue.
All right.
And mm-hmm. you're just going to abandon it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so there's a lot at stake emotionally mm-hmm. in maintaining the faith, because you've been warned. Mm-hmm. If you go in this direction, X, Y, and Z is going to happen to you. But, I mean, don't get me started. I just think it is what it is. Mm-hmm. And studying the Bible and studying the philosophical context within which we're reading the Bible, to me, that's fascinating stuff. Mm-hmm. And I truly, truly believe that if we don't have a God that we think understands that we're just right. trying to understand, mm-hmm. then all this is nonsense anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right. So as we kind of wrap this up, what are ways that we can see these things? Moses didn't write the Pentateuch. We see different sources in these texts. We see historical development. We see fingerprints of humanity all over this
all
thing.
Over it. Yeah.
How does that mesh with a faith beyond a modern mindset for you?
I think what it does is it, I'm going to use the word you hate.
I know it's coming. I know it's mystery. Coming.
But it's not just that, but it's one reason the Bible never gets old for me is because it's like, it's all over the place,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I can't wrap my arms around it. I'm fine with that. And to me, that is a picture of faith, that it's, we're stepping into something that exceeds our limitations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when I see the Bible with different voices speaking and having different opinions on things, I'm seeing a dialogue, that very same dialogue going back through the millennia. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the beauty of the Bible. It's not that it gives you all the answers. It's that if you take it seriously, it forces you to live with some discomfort at times,
mm-hmm.
and realizing this is an adult book. And it's, there's a tradition that goes way back, and people have, there's nothing that we can see that people haven't seen in the past. There's no new data. It's a question is, what do you do with it? And, you know, for me, it's simply a matter of being willing to take the risk, which I think is required in faith, to explore and to be curious and try to understand as best as we can. And to me, the whole issue of, like, what do you think God is like is wrapped up in all that stuff. Because I've come to be over the years very comfortable, not just comfortable, but very grateful for a notion of God where I'm just like a little kid trying to figure out how to use the crayon, you know? And it's like, I'm limited myself, but I'm doing it honestly. I'm trying to do it honestly. I'm not trying to defend a particular view, because without it, I'll freak out. Where's the faith in that? That to me. So I think the Bible is about as impossible to wrap up into a modernist mindset as anything, because it's ancient, it's weird, it's diverse, it's all over the place, it's internally contradictory.
Right.
You just can't make the system out of it, but it can be a means of grace too for the life of faith.
Right. That's well put. Yeah. And I think the only thing I would add for me is I get excited when we have these conversations, because this idea of reimagining the Bible requires our participation.
Yeah.
And I think that's scary for some, but I think if we can move beyond that, it actually gets very, it's very exciting for me. We get to participate in this faith tradition, in its survival, its expansion, its shifts,
it's evolution.
It's evolution, baby.
Yeah. Anyway, it's just, there's a lot to think about, and that's why theology and biblical studies in almost any discipline that's related to philosophy, it's not ending, and that's okay, because we're limited people. We're trying to make sense of things, and that's what we're doing here.
And we want to make 10 more seasons of this podcast.
Of course.
So we need it to not end. I mean, it's a little bit self-serving, but...
So there you go, folks. Okay.
We just,
that's the capitalist mindset right there.
That's the real agenda. All right. Well, thanks everybody for participating in this conversation with us. We hope that it's helpful, because I think it really does come back to those two questions of what is the Bible and what do we do with it, which is in itself, you say this a lot, that asking those questions in community and talking about it is the process of theologizing. It is the process of expressing our Christian faith.
And over season 9, we'll be doing more and more of that.
Well, thanks to everyone who supports the show. If you want to support what we do, there are 3 ways you can do it. One, if you just want to give a little money, go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/give.
And if you want to support us and want an all-access pass to our classes, ad-free live stream of the podcast, and a thoughtful community of people asking tough questions about the Bible and faith, you can become a member of our online community, the Society of Normal People, at thebiblefornormalpeople.com/join.
And lastly, it goes a long way if you just wanted to rate the podcast, leave a review, and tell others about our show. In addition, you can let us know what you thought about the episode by emailing us at info@thebiblefornormalpeople.com.
You've just made it through another episode of The Bible for Normal People. Don't forget, you can catch our other show, Faith for Normal People, in the same feed wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was brought to you by the Bible for Normal People team: Brittany Hodge, Stephen Henning, Joel Limbowen, Savannah Locke, Melissa Yando, Tessa Stoltz, Danny Wong, Lauren O'Connell, and Naomi Gonzalez.
I think you're getting better.
I don't want to get better.
You need to
then
get better.
Then I'm losing my Texan.
I know. That's the whole point.
I don't want to lose my Texan. I've already lost the accent.
I just thought it was adorable.
I think that's...
No, you do not have a Texas accent.
I think that's assimilation.